The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireu. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Adam Alter. Adam is an associate professor of marketing at New York University's Stern School of Business. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller Drunk Tank Pink and has written for the New York Times, New Yorker, Atlantic, Wired, Slate, and more. His latest book is called Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So there are many reasons that I personally recommend improvisation classes to people. But given the technology-driven world we live in, my latest pitch to people is that when you take an improv class, you're separated from your smartphone for 3 hours, you're forced to look other people in the eye, and you rediscover the basic wonder of play. It sounds to me like that might connect to you after research and writing this book.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's right. So, you know, one of the most staggering findings that I came across is that if you have a smartphone in a room and it's visible, so say you have two people having a conversation and there's a phone that's turned upside down but it's sitting in view, mm-hmm. the quality of the connection that those two people form will be diminished just because there's a phone in the room.
Wow. The mere presence of the phone.
The mere presence of the phone. So if you want people to connect, you basically have to make them be as present as possible. And the thing that a phone does immediately is it reminds you of what else is out there in the world. And so it removes you from the present.
I thought it was interesting, too. You open this book by noting that Steve Jobs, Chris Anderson, Evan Williams, all these huge tech pioneers either didn't allow their own children onto digital platforms or strictly enforced their screen time.
Yeah, I mean, who knows better than these experts, the people who produce this kind of tech or who write about it or who spend their time very deeply immersed in it. There's actually a school in the Bay Area that doesn't allow tech at all. There are no computers, no smartphones, no tablets, which is unusual for schools these days. 75% of the kids who attend that school are the children of tech execs in Silicon Valley. So, you know, I think when you start seeing experts in an area refuse to allow their kids access to programs that they're telling the rest of the world are terrific and worth paying attention to, I think that suggests that there's an issue that needs a lot of attention.
Yeah, my wife and I are lucky. We got our kids into a Waldorf school. And for those that don't know, the Waldorf education is essentially no media in early childhood or even in the grade school. And even in the high school, they're still painting and doing a ton of music. And because my wife and I both have been connected to media for our whole lives, we have a very media-rich house. But the kids weren't luxuriating in it, and so, you know, they're still surrounded by books and they know how to talk to each other. You actually remind us that these platforms are really still very new to us. You wrote, as an experience evolves, it becomes an irresistible, weaponized version of the experience it once was. In 2004, Facebook was fun. In 2016, it's addictive. So what happened over that time span?
I think what happens with a lot of these experiences is that there's an sort of evolutionary process where they evolve and they become they become better versions that that producers could send out into the world and that are harder for people to resist because they constantly A-B test different features. They introduce new features. They speak to behavioral experts who tell them which things will work and which things are less likely to work. The best example, I think, is video games, and especially games that are released through the internet, because what happens is the producers of those games will release, say, three different versions of a mission. Let's say it's one of those games where you're trying to complete missions, and they'll have three initial versions, maybe one where you have to find something, another one where you have to save something, and another one where you have to kill something, and they'll see, turns out people play the game for much more time and return to the mission more often when they have to, say, save something.
Mm-hmm.
So what they'll do is they'll do away with the other options. They'll release now three new versions where you have to save something. And they'll tweak other little factors, and then they'll keep doing that, say, 20 times. And so what you have is a sort of 20th generation evolved version of that game that is much harder to resist than the original versions were because they've weeded out the less addictive, less, versions with fewer hooks.
Right. You also talk about, I remember the first CD-ROM game I played was Myst.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, and it's like, you brought that up in the book. I'm like, I remember Myst. I actually remember having a lot of fun with that. But I imagine if anyone played Myst today, they'd be like, what is this?
Exactly, yeah. It seems very clunky when you look back. And I think the interesting thing about Myst was the game was superior to the hardware that you were running it on. So it never really worked the way it should have.
Right.
And I think that's one of the big factors that makes this such a dangerous era, that now the hardware can keep up with the software. And so we're able to receive really rapid feedback in ways that I don't think we could when we were playing games, say, 20 years ago.
So the games have changed and evolved, and our attention span appears to have gone the other way.
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons for that. The main one, though, is that you really don't have to think. You don't have to act on the world when you have something like an iPad or a tablet or a smartphone in front of you. What it does is it basically visits content upon you. So all you have to do is turn it on, and it will entertain you. Mm-hmm. And I think what that does is it makes you the privileged consumer that has the opportunity to do whatever you'd like at any moment, and so the content has to capture you. And so you lose the ability to sort of make your own fun, to really devote your own attention to something. And that's a real change from where we were, say, 20 years ago. Certainly TVs were doing that, but when you left the home, there was no TV wherever you were. And so you had long breaks from TVs. But today, because phones go with us everywhere, tablets go with us everywhere, you always have the option to sort of soothe your boredom by just picking up a device. And that means that your attention span generally doesn't need to be longer than absolutely necessary.
Well, and you cite a Microsoft study, which is rather stunning, which says in 2000, the average human had an attention span of 12 seconds. But by 2013, that number had fallen to 8 seconds. And I think the most depressing part of this stat is that a goldfish, by comparison, has an attention span of 9 seconds. I mean, we're a second below goldfish.
Yeah, exactly. So things aren't looking so good. You know, there are a lot of possible reasons why our attention spans might have changed, but that study offers at least one data point that I think is quite concerning.
I was talking to a group of students who were visiting Chicago, and they came to Second City, and they asked me, well, what was the difference when Second City started in 1959 to right now? And I said, oh, the scenes used to be much longer. You know, if you look at those old shows, most of the scenes were 13, 14 minutes, and today you're lucky if you can get 4 or 5 minutes out of a scene. And that's not just due to a shortened attention span. There's probably other reasons, but that's, I think, part of it. What's also really great about and interesting about this book is you provide a history and a context for addiction. And you talk about the history of addiction. And it's important to understand attempts to control or combat this phenomenon because you write, time has made a fool of experts who once believed addiction was reserved for a wretched minority. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think when we have stereotypes of addicts and of addiction, we think of people on the fringes of society, people who are particularly unwell, people who are not in the mainstream. And that's really just not true anymore. That may have been true at one point in time, but I think cigarettes changed that, certainly, for a very long time in the middle of the 20th century. And now at least 50% of the population has at least one behavioral addiction. So you can't consider addiction a thing that's reserved for, or a problem reserved for the sort of wretched few. And so I think anyone who thinks of addicts as this sort of very, very narrow group is making a mistake.
Yeah, you say behavioral addicts look a lot like drug addicts. That's not a leap.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, in some ways they do. I think the effects of drug addiction are probably more extreme for most
sure.
people. There are certainly people who play games or who gamble who have major, major problems. But, you know, some form of behavioral addiction, even moderate form of behavioral addiction, does diminish our well-being to some extent. And certainly a huge part of the population suffers that way, about 50% or perhaps even more. And your brain, when you experience, you know, say you're a video game player and you've become addicted, you compulsively play a game. When you fire that game up, your brain will look the same as the brain of someone who's about to inject a drug if they're addicted to that drug. It's very, very hard to distinguish when you just look at brain patterns.
You also talk about sleep deprivation, and you talk about blue light. What is blue light?
Blue light is it's generally a pretty unnatural light. It's associated, if anything, with daytime, and it's part of the light spectrum that you would never normally have naturally at night. So, you know, the way we lit things up over history was with things like candles, and candles emit a sort of yellow, warm, rich light. But now the devices that we use, the screens we use, emit a lot of this sort of bluer, whiter light. And our brains associate that kind of light with daytime, with daylight. And what that means is that if you play with these devices or you use screens or you use tablets in the 90 minutes or so before bed, you're signaling to your body that it's daytime. And you disrupt the natural process that occurs as you slowly wind down towards bedtime. So one of the major prescriptions is you should not use screens 90 minutes before bed.
Yeah. My wife told me about this a while ago of, like, do not put the phone next to your bed.
Exactly, yeah. And a lot of people do. And, you know, there have been experiments done where people are asked at various points in the day and sometimes even at night, without moving your feet right now, can you reach your phone? And for most people, for most of the day, if not all of the day, the answer is yes.
Yep, that's I'm answering yes to that. Not healthy.
Yeah. I think one of the things to do, this is sort of a really good litmus test, is the more time during the day where you can answer no to that, the better you're doing on that front. So what you should strive for, I think, if you feel that you're overusing your phone and maybe using it as a crutch, is that over time there are more minutes in the day or more hours in the day where the answer to that is no.
Yeah. That's a great idea. So you also talk about goals. And I think for most people, the idea of setting goals feels like a totally good thing. But you write that, quote, we're living through an unprecedented age of goal culture, a period underscored by addictive perfectionism, self-assessment, more time at work, and less time at play. Why can goals be bad?
I think goals are bad basically by their nature, by their setup. I think the way we think of a goal is unhelpful. And the reason for that is that, you know, you have two states with goals. The one state is before you've reached the goal, which by definition is in essence, it's failure. Until you reach the goal, if you use that as your yardstick, you are below that level that you would like to be at. That in itself is a bit damaging. But once you reach the goal, what tends to happen is that you sort of reach a new equilibrium, you calm down, you feel like this is a good thing for a while, but then the positive feeling that you get from having achieved that goal diminishes and you start needing to create a new goal. It's a sort of iterative procedure where every time you achieve one goal, you start to create another one.
And is this something connected to productivity or what we think productivity is?
Yeah, it is. And there's also some very interesting research in the psychology literature showing that people will work long past the point where they have enough resources. So if you say that you need a certain amount of money to be happy, the way we get on this sort of work treadmill is we go and we go and we go. And then when you reach the point where you have enough, you just keep going. Just because there's an inertia to that process, it becomes hard to stop. And a lot of people will overwork beyond the point where they have everything they need, which doesn't really make sense. You know, that to live a good life, in essence, what you should be doing is working as hard as you need to have the resources you need to then, you know, I guess, spend them to enjoy the rest of your life. And that's just not how we do things. We spend far too much time working and not enough time enjoying ourselves.
Yeah, well, we kind of get ourselves in these loops and patterns, right? And then we can't, we're hooked, right? We can't get off it. And whether you're hooked on the money train or the power train or whatever. And then if you add into it things like instant messages and emails, which are constantly coming in and combating for our attention, I mean, like the instant message now feels like the worst thing, the worst invention that man ever made.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is one of the big prescriptions as well, is that at the moment your phone tells you when you need to pay attention to it. So it'll ding, or something will flash or light up, or there'll be a notification. The best thing to do with your phone is to take all those notifications and turn them off, because what then happens is you decide when you want to play with your phone or turn your phone on or check your messages. And unless there's an emergency that you need to be told about immediately, there's really no need for your phone to keep infringing on your life, to keep interrupting and telling you it's time to pay attention to me.
So isn't then like wearable tech like even worse?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think it is. I've spoken to a lot of exercise addicts, not just the addicts, but also the people who treat exercise addiction.
Uh-huh.
And they all say basically the same thing, which is that walking around with a device that counts how many steps you take is great if you're sedentary and you don't move at all, because it does prompt you to move. But it's a slippery slope, and what ends up happening is you keep escalating. So the first day you have a Fitbit or a smartwatch, you want to take, say, 10,000 steps. And the next day, 10,000 doesn't feel like such an impressive number. You go up to 12,000, then 14, then 16, and so on. People will work through major injuries, stress injuries, and they'll just keep going, because the escalation process means that, as we said with goals, you never really feel like the goal that you've achieved today is enough. And the next day you need to escalate it further. And that process doesn't really end, so you end up injuring yourself.
Yeah, I found that whole shift to escalation really interesting in your book. You actually noted that Google Books says there's more than, like, I don't know, it was like 30,000 books about making life easier, but there's no evidence that people actually with regular lives become happier. I think you say when you replace challenges with ease.
Yeah. I mean, people think they want life to be easy. If you say, would you like your life to be easier, most people say yes. But a lot of people in the developed world will introduce challenges and difficulties into their own lives. They'll run marathons, they'll climb mountains, they'll do things that essentially in the moment are harder. They'll introduce hardships, and those hardships often give their lives meaning, and they embrace those hardships.
I will admit to being a complete nerd, and I read your paper on cognitive disfluency. So, because this is very interesting to me in improvisation, because the whole idea in improv is upsetting patterns, right? And you're creating a script with someone, and you don't know what the dialogue's going to be. And if I'm understanding the idea from your paper correctly, because there were a lot of big words in there, cognitive fluency is why it's how we're not crashing into each other, you know, on the street, and these patterns that we know. But the idea that if you are comfortable with the disfluency, there's a depth, and innovation comes from there, and that's what we find at Second City.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That people are cognitive misers. They don't like spending any more mental effort than they absolutely need to at any point in time. We're kind of lazy that way.
Mm-hmm.
And cognitive disfluency is the idea that you skate along, things are pretty easy most of the time, but what really gets you out of that reverie and pushes you to think more deeply is something that jars you and says, hey, in this particular instance, you need to recruit additional mental resources, otherwise you won't make a good decision. And disfluency does that. Disfluency is basically the idea that certain things in the environment are hard for us to make sense of or to process. So you could imagine if you're reading a page of text and one line is written in a font that's a bit it's grayer, it's harder to see, maybe it's a little bit more ornate, so you're using a different font. That line will be harder to read, and what will happen then is you'll automatically recruit additional resources and you'll read it more carefully and more slowly. And so you can knock people out of this state of fluency, make them think a little bit more deeply by presenting them information that's harder to process.
Yeah, we're looking at we have a partnership with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth, and we're testing out some of these ideas of discomfort and whether just sort of cueing someone that it's supposed to be uncomfortable will make them drive through it more. And spend more time. And our hypothesis is it's going to happen.
I think so, yeah. If you put roadblocks in front of people, they're forced to work their way around them. And so I think as long as those roadblocks aren't insurmountable, it's a good idea.
Yeah, Tim Harford, his book Messy, talks about Keith Jarrett doing the famous Cone concert where one of the greatest recorded jazz albums of all time, and it turns out the piano was broken.
Right.
So he has to work around. Can you explain, it was in this escalation part where you talked about a ludic loop.
Yeah. So ludic basically means game related. So this is the loop you get into where you may have experienced this, where you're playing a game. And what happens is when you think of playing games, you think of sort of joy, the enjoyment of the process. But what people describe when they play games, and actually also among gambling addicts when they're sitting at a slot machine, is not this state of excitement, but a state of sort of calm. And you get into this loop, this process where you just keep iterating over and over again. You keep doing the same thing over and over as though you're in this sort of tranquil, not particularly engaged state. And that's what happens with a ludic loop. It's what happens when you know you've created the right kind of game that will engage people for a long period of time. And the people who create slot machines, for example, the thing that they use to measure the success of those machines is called time on device. Mm-hmm. And it's a measure of how long most people on average will sit in front of the device. And they won't sit in front of the device if it's exciting necessarily, but they will sit in front of it for a long time if they are lulled into this sort of state of this ludic loop, this state where they just feel relaxed and calm.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's all the mobile games now. That's even Tetris, right, from a while ago, and Flappy Bird, and Angry Bird, and all these things are so simple. And you're like, why are these so popular? Because there's really not much more to it. But it is, like, because I've done a couple of these things, it's almost like you're lulling yourself into a feeling that it feels good, I guess.
Yeah, and they're very repetitive. You just need to master a couple of really basic moves. Some of the games only involve a single action. There are some games where you just tap the phone, and that action, you just tap at different speeds, and that makes a character jump or run. Mm-hmm. And it's that simplicity that people find really appealing. Now, you can make the game very complex despite that relying on just that single action, but it's the simplicity that leads to these ludic loops and these feelings of, tranquil contentment as you're playing the game.
So related somewhat, I think, is when you talk about the stopping rule. And I loved the thing that I guess you call the butt brush effect. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the butt brush effect. This is an effect that was identified in the retail setting. So a lot of stores want to know, how do we encourage people to spend more time in our stores, to buy more, to pick more items off the rack and so on. This is especially department stores. And one of the department stores hired a team to investigate this question. And they filmed thousands of hours of footage. And what they found was, in stores where the aisles are a little bit too narrow, people will brush up against each other accidentally as they go by. So imagine I'm standing and looking at some clothes. Someone might try to get by me. And if they accidentally brush my butt as they go by, if they accidentally move by and touch me, what they found was that those people who are brushed will sort of leave the store very quickly thereafter. So even if they're sort of deeply engrossed, they're playing with an item, they'll tend to leave at that point or very soon thereafter. And the idea was that people had no idea that they were doing this. When you interview them and say, why did you leave the store? They don't say, because someone just brushed by me. But that is a sort of stopping rule that activates something in them that says you should move on to the next thing. It's perhaps a little bit unpleasant, a low level of unpleasantness, but it also just signals a change. It jars them from that reverie that they were in when they were shopping. So it's a little bit like this cognitive disfluency we talked about earlier. It's something that stops whatever sort of consistent motion they're involved in and moves them on to the next thing.
You know, it's interesting. At Second City in Chicago, like, the seating is very tight. And I've worked at Second City since 1988, and I used to seat the room there, so almost 30 years. And people are all, like, they're increasingly less happy with this in terms of they kind of touch each other. But by the end of the show, what we know, especially in a community where you want people to laugh, it's that sort of closeness that allows for the sort of group laugh to come out. So what starts as potentially an unpleasant experience always ends as a positive experience. But I swear to God, it is, you know, nightly arguments with people like, this is the way the seating is.
Yeah, and that resonates for me as a teacher as well. I know that My preference when I started teaching was, I always assumed it would be better to teach fewer students, that would be a good thing, that it would be easier to manage the class. And that actually turns out not to be true. Obviously, you don't want too many students, but there's a sort of sweet spot where you have enough people that you have those electric interactions. With too few people, you just don't have that. There's no buzz.
Yep.
It doesn't seem to work as well. So I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, my wife is a teacher. She says the same things. And it's the sort of social interaction. I was talking about your book with my 14-year-old daughter because she was complaining about text fights with her friends.
Right.
And she has friends Like, anytime they get into a text fight, she's like, can we video chat? Can I call you? Or can we talk about this in person? And literally, there's a couple friends who won't do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think video chats and even more face-to-face conversations have a sort of riskiness to them that you don't really have when you're texting or when you're just sending very precise communication in the form of words and exclamation points and things like that. There's something really comforting about being able to say, I think what you've just said is funny, in the form of LOL four exclamation points, because you communicate very precisely exactly what you mean. When you're standing in front of someone and they do something funny, there are so many different ways to react. Who knows if it'll be received the right way? Will you laugh the right amount? Will you have not laughed enough? So there's an inherent anxiety in communicating face-to-face with people. Now, we get over that anxiety over time by spending more time in face-to-face communication. But if you never really have that when you're growing up, and more children today don't have that, mm-hmm. then it's very anxiety-provoking. So what many people might find to be a trivial experience, just having to, you know, have a conversation face-to-face, if you haven't had many of those conversations when you're young, as you get older, they become more and more daunting, and it becomes much easier to just rely on the crutch of texting.
Yeah, and that's terrible, because it's already hard to have difficult conversations for those of us who grew up without computers. When I ran Second City, I was never good at the difficult conversation with people who work for me, because we don't like to do it. Like, no one wants to be, you know, in that. And now you've got people who are completely unpracticed in ever trying to resolve something in person. That strikes me as could be really socially negative in the years to come.
Yeah, it's potentially very damaging. And, you know, the honest truth is we don't know exactly how damaging, because the iPhone is only 10 years old. The iPad is 7 years old. And the kids who were born into those eras, the iPhone and iPad eras, are, again, only 7 or 10 years old. We don't know what they're going to be like as teens or as adults. There's some evidence that there's a critical period when you're maturing where if you spend all your time away from other people in front of screens, you're not developing certain competencies. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you bully someone, you say something that's not nice, it's really important to get the feedback in real time that you've upset them. You need them to be sad. You need to see tears, or you need to see their face scrunch up when you're young, mm-hmm. because that teaches you this is not a good thing to do.
Right.
And it sounds really obvious if you know that that's not a good thing to do, but as a kid, you need to have that feedback.
Yeah.
Now, if you're bullying someone over screens, or you don't actually see everything in an immediate way, you never really learn that. And it changes the way you communicate. It makes you a less subtle communicator, and I think it could make you potentially more nasty.
Yeah, I think it was This American Life. They had a woman who had been trolled actually confronting one of her trollers who was very regretful once he started having those conversations, because I think even just voice to voice, that became a whole different thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right. So we talked a lot about how terrible this all is. But you have some good stories about companies that are figuring out ways to sort of nudge ourselves, to take a term from choice architecture, to protect their employees. My favorite was the story from Daimler about the vacation emails.
Yeah, this is a terrific, terrific story. That, you know, one of the most terrible things about going on vacation is coming back to long lists of emails that
the
you
worst.
Have to deal with. And so you end up spending the first few days just trying to catch up, mm-hmm. which is not a good way to end a vacation. That's a good way to get stressed immediately on coming back. Mm-hmm. So Daimler has this approach where if you are on vacation, your vacation message is set. So what happens is if someone sends an email to you, they automatically get a reply that says, your email has been deleted because this person is on vacation. They will never see it. They won't get hold of it. If you really need something urgently, please send your email to, and then they give you another contact, or email this person after their vacation ends. And what that does is it means that if you go on vacation, whatever your inbox looked like when you left will be exactly how it looks when you come back. And that's very appealing to people.
I told that story to a couple of people I work with, and their shoulders dropped. There was like a light came on their face of like, could that world be possible?
Yeah, it's very, very appealing to a lot of people who find that act of coming back from vacation very unpleasant.
You also talk about an educational company called Quest to Learn. How are they helping in this sphere?
Yeah, so Quest to Learn is it's a school in New York City, and what they do is they've gamified pretty much everything they do, all the educational practices they engage in. So when you think about lessons that you might learn at school, you can turn pretty much any lesson into a game where knowledge is the goal or the outcome. And what they do, for example, let's say there's a module on learning about the parts of the body or the way the body works. They'll have a quest where there's someone who's lost inside the body. There's a little miniaturized person. In this case, they actually have a module called Dr. Smalls. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Smalls is a tiny little person, and he's lost inside the body somewhere. And your job over the course of weeks is to learn about the different parts of the body, to locate him and help him get out of the body, out of someone's body. And so what you do in the course of that is you accumulate knowledge. Each piece of knowledge becomes a sort of little reward, a different level completed, if we're going to use game terms. Mm-hmm. And so kids get really engaged because as they go along, they're getting more and more points towards this final outcome. And then at the end of it, there's a big reward that you've completed the mission and Dr. Smalls has been released from the body. And they do this with a whole lot of different kinds of lessons. And by gamifying education, they make it much harder to resist. Instead of kids being forced to learn, they're actually engaged and enjoying the process.
Yeah, I mean, that's our stuff, right? Because improvisation is a pedagogy. It's a way of learning, and the learning happens in the doing. So, you know, we have all these exercises that reveal really, like, interesting things and knowledge in the person who's doing them that you could give all the lectures in the world, and they're, you know, maybe going to brush off.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're coming to the end of our time together, and before I ask you for a yes and story, which I do want to ask you about in your own life. So in writing this book, it would strike me that you could become very depressed about the future of individuals, the world, and all that. But where did you end up sitting after you finished the book?
I felt actually fairly empowered, which was good, because I knew there was a problem. I felt there was a problem. I'd spent too many cross-country flights playing games instead of doing the things I planned to do, like working and sleeping. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I understand better what it is that makes these experiences so hard to resist, and that's half the battle. Once you understand how they get their hooks into you, you can understand how to remove those hooks or at least deal with them in some way. So I feel better about them. I should say this. I am myself a tech evangelist. I think tech is terrific. I think it's made my life much better. It allows me to communicate with my family halfway across the world. And mm-hmm. without tech, I wouldn't be able to do so many of the things that I enjoy. I just think, you know, using the language of environmentalism, we need to use tech sustainably. And so I feel that I've come out of this with a better sense of how to interact with tech in this world.
Yeah. That makes sense. All right. So the podcast is called Getting to Yes And, and we ask every guest if they have a yes and story. So the idea behind this is that most default positions are doing nothing, and often that's saying no. But in improv, you can't just stop at saying yes. You have to say yes and in order to explore and heighten. I'm wondering if you have a time in your life or work where you normally would have said no, but you actually said yes and what happened?
Yeah, I love that idea. I really like the question. I think it's a great question to ask yourself. And for me, I would say the biggest yes and moment was saying yes to my first book. I was a first year professor, and I was pretty overwhelmed by making the transition from grad student to professor. And a journalist had written a piece about some of the work I did, and the piece he wrote was really interesting, and he made my work sound about as interesting as it could possibly sound. And on the back of that, a number of literary agents called me and said, you should write a book about this stuff. Hmm. And I found the idea of writing a book at that point in my career completely overwhelming. My default response was certainly no. But I thought about it more, and I realized that in the long run, that was something I wanted to do. And so I wanted to strike while the iron was hot. And I eventually said, you know what, why don't I try? I'll write a proposal, and if a publisher wants to publish the book, I'll just run with the process. Mm-hmm. And so I said yes. And now I've written my second book, which is out in a few days, and it's, I feel that it really did change my life, having said yes to that question.
Yeah, it's easy to fall into imposter syndrome, I think, even for those of us who, you know, have some measurement of success that other people would look at and go, well, yeah, you can write a book.
Absolutely, yeah.
Adam Alter, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly.
smoking in a car.